Still no sign of land. How long is it?
That's a rather personal question, sir.
You stupid git. I meant how long has it been in the lifeboat? You've destroyed the atmosphere now.
I'm sorry.
Shut up. We'll start again.
Still no sign of land. How long is it?
33 days.
33 days.
We can't go on much longer.
I didn't think I destroyed that.
Shut up.
I don't think I did.
Of course you did.
Did you?
Yes, I did. Shut up. Shut up.
Still no sign of land. How long is it?
33 days, sir.
Have we started again?
Still no sign of land. How long is it?
33 days, sir.
33 days?
We can't go on much longer, sir. We haven't eaten since the fifth day.
We're done for. We're done for.
Shut up, Maudling.
We've just got to keep hoping. Someone may find us.
How are you feeling, Captain? Not too good. I feel so weak.
We can't hold out much longer.
Listen, chaps, there's still a chance. I'm done for. I've got a gammy leg and I'm going fast. I'll never get through, but some of you might. So, you'd better eat me.
Eat you, sir?
Yes, eat me.
Ugh, with a gammy leg?
You didn't eat the leg, Thompson. There's still plenty of good meat. Look at that arm.
It's not just the leg, sir.
What do you mean?
Well, sir, it's just that...
Why don't you want to eat me?
I'd rather eat Johnson, sir.
So would I, sir.
I see. Well, that's settled then. Everyone's going to eat me.
Oh, well...
What, sir?
Go ahead, please, but I won't...
Oh, nonsense, sir. You're starving. Duck in.
No, it's not that.
What's the matter with Johnson, sir?
Well, he's not kosher.
That depends how we kill him, sir.
Yes, that's true. But to be perfectly frank, I like my meat a little more lean. I'd rather eat Hodges.
Oh, well, all right.
I still prefer Johnson.
We should all stop bickering and eat me.
Look, I tell you what. Those who want to can eat Johnson, and you, sir, can have my leg, and we'll make some stock from the captain, and then we'll have Johnson cold for supper.
Oh, well, that's a good idea.
Excellent thinking.
Very good. For us, we could have Hodges in the morning.
That's a jolly
good idea. Well, we could have sort of Johnson kedgeree.
And so, with a sinister-looking crew assembled by Long John Silver, the ship was ready to get underway. Captain Smollett, however, was not pleased with the way the crew had been gathered, but agreed to sail as long as precautions were taken. It is the following morning. The sun is shining and casts a sparkling reflection on the sea. The ship is underway. The men have climbed the mizzenmast, the sails are hoisted, first the larger ones and then the small sea sails at the top of the masts. Soon all the sails are billowing in the fresh sea breeze, and the good ship Hispaniola is a majestic sight as it glides out of Bristol Harbor. The riggings are secure, the bow cuts through the waters, and the ship is on its way to an unknown treasure island. During the securing of all ship's lines, the first mate found a concealed weapon on George Mary, a crew member and friend of Long John Silver. Captain Smollett warned the crew that no man is to carry a weapon on a peaceful mission.
I'll have to turn mine in, too.
Yeah. You ain't let no one see it, have
you? No, sir.
Then it'd go hard with Long John if you was to turn it in now.
But why?
Well, here's a captain with a suspicious turn of mind. And here's Long John handing out firearms to an able-bodied seaman like yourself.
But I'd do no harm with it.
Would you keep him out of sight?
Yes, sir.
You're a good un, Jim. I seen that from the start.
Holding the pistol Penny had brought him, Sir Halsey peers over the gunwale at the three men who seem to be unconscious.
It's the three convicts, all right. They fit the description perfectly. Julia, get on the radio to the Coast Guard while
Never mind the radio, lady.
Daddy!
Oh,
just don't move anybody. Okay, Ish, Bonnie, get on board.
Wait a minute. We'll give you food if that's what you need.
Yeah, it is. We need food and a good fast boat. And it looks like you got all those things, buddy, so we'll swap. We'll take your boat and you can have ours. Go on, climb into it, all of you.
We'd better do as he says, my dear. Girls, you go first and help your mother.
All right, Daddy. Come on, Gwen.
Now you, Mummy.
Yes, dears. There we are. Halsey?
Coming.
Wait a minute. I changed my mind. We're going to need you to help run this boat, so you stay.
But my wife and the girls, they can't reach the island alone. Look at that surf.
It's not our problem. Bonnie, shove the boat free.
Oh, I beg you. Please don't take my husband.
Don't take Daddy, please.
They'll never make it to shore.
Never mind about them. Get this boat running. Move!
If anything happens to them...
It will if you don't get us out of here.
But I... Very well.
Sandy could hardly believe what he had just seen.
They stole that boat. They're pirates. What's Flipper trying to tell me? Oh, the rowboat's in trouble.
Lady Julia and her two daughters, Gwen and Penny, struggle to bring the rowboat toward shore. Suddenly, one of the floorboards gives way and the boat begins to sink.
The leak, Mummy. We're going down.
It's getting harder to row. Penny, Gwen, kick off your shoes quickly. We'll have to swim for sure.
But it's too far. We'll never reach it.
Mummy! Dry, girls. Got to dry.
Keeping hidden behind some rocks, Sandy rushes to the water's edge with the life ring from his own rowboat.
Flipper! Take this life ring out there. It may save them. Go on, hurry.
Yes, I love it. The sea is everything. It covers 7/10 of the terrestrial globe. Its breath is pure and healthy. It is an immense desert where man is never lonely, for he feels life stirring on all sides. Ah, sir, live. Live in the bosom of the waters. There only is independence. There I recognize no masters. There I am free. Now, Professor, he said, if you wish to go over the Nautilus, I am at your service. Captain Nemo rose. I followed him. A double door contrived at the back of the dining room opened, and I entered a room equal in dimensions to that which I had just quitted. It was a library. High pieces of furniture of black, violet ebony, inlaid with brass, supported upon their wide shelves a great number of books, uniformly bound. I looked with real admiration at this room, so ingeniously fitted up, and I could scarcely believe my eyes. Captain Nemo, I said to my host, who had just thrown himself on one of the divans, this is a library which would do honor to more than one of the continental palaces. And I am absolutely astounded when I consider that it can follow you to the bottom of the seas. At that moment, Captain Nemo opened a door which stood opposite to that by which I had entered the library. 30 first-rate pictures, uniformly framed, separated by bright drapery, ornamented the walls, which were hung with tapestry of severe design. Professor, said this strange man, you must excuse the unceremonious way in which I receive you, and the disorder of this room. Sir, I answered, without seeking to know who you are, I recognize in you an artist. An amateur, nothing more, sir. Under elegant glass cases, fixed by copper rivets, were classed and labeled the most precious productions of the sea, which had ever been presented to the eye of a naturalist. My delight as a professor may be conceived. Ah, bravo, bravo, Captain. But how could you construct this wonderful Nautilus in secret? Each separate portion, Monsieur Aronnax, was brought from different parts of the globe. But these parts had to be put together and arranged. Professor, I had set up my workshops upon a desert island in the ocean. There, my workmen, that is to say, the brave men that I instructed and educated, and myself, have put together our Nautilus. Then, when the work was finished, fire destroyed all trace of our proceedings on this island, which I could have jumped over if I had liked. One last question, Captain Nemo. Ask it, Professor. You are rich? Immensely rich, sir. And I could, without missing it, pay the national debt of France.
Then and there I passed from death unto life. I became a new creature in Christ Jesus. Oh God, I prayed, if you'll only straighten out my life, I'll serve you all the rest of my days. God began to work that very moment in my life. Would my wife take me back? I wouldn't blame her if she didn't. I'd go back to Los Angeles and see. Carfare home? I didn't have a penny. I'd have to hitchhike my way. I didn't know how God was going to work it all out, but I had the absolute assurance that whatever came into my life would be best for me. And it was well with my soul. So, at last, I came back home to my wife and kiddies. Thelma, I've found Christ, and he's real to me at last. This was my greeting to her who was the mother of my babies. God alone knows how many sleepless nights she prayed for my soul's salvation. With the wonderful love of Christ in her heart, she took me back. Honey, I said, I'm going into full-time service of the Lord. I don't know where or how. I made him that promise, and I know that he'll open a door somewhere. She prayed with me that God would have his way.
No, 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 no! Don't shoot! You wouldn't harm Ben Gunn. Oh, poor Ben Gunn I am! And I haven't spoke with a Christian these 5 years.
5 years? Were you shipwrecked?
Nay, mate. Marooned.
Tell me, mate. Would that be Flint's ship?
No, Flint's dead. The master of that ship's a gentleman, Captain Smollett.
Gentleman, says you. Flint's men, says I. I've seen 'em.
Some of them are Flint's men. But they got aboard by a trick.
Is there a man with one leg among them?
Long John Silver.
Nay, we were sent by him. I'm as good as pork, and I knows it.
No, you don't understand. He's trying to take me as hostage. I hate John Silver.
And fear him too, says you. Everybody feared Flint's quartermaster.
It was him as marooned me here. I ain't had a mouthful of Christian diet. These 5 years. Marooned 5 years. And lived on goats and berries. Many's the night I dreamed of cheese.
A toasting mostly. You wouldn't have a rind of cheese about you, would you now?
There's cheese by the hundredweight aboard ship. Now, if you could help me row a longboat.
Both of you, Ben Gunn, your men, says I. What might you call yourself, mate?
Jim.
Jim. Jim. Well now, Jim, you just follow Ben Gunn.
Captain Nemo gave each of us a diving suit. One by one, we were gently shot out of the ship through a diving tube and found ourselves standing on the ocean floor. We could see the crew of the Nautilus going about their work with axes, hoes, pikes, and floating baskets to carry the food back to the ship. What we saw was a complete farm, and the crewmen as farmers were tilling the undersea soil.
Professor Aronnax, I'll take you to our undersea farm. We can choose tomorrow's dinner.
Good. Conseil, are you coming with me?
I see an old sunken pirate ship, Uncle. I'd rather explore that.
I'll go with him, Professor.
Excellent. Stick close to Ned, Conseil. We will meet again later aboard the Nautilus.
We half walked, half floated along the bottom of the sea. Thousands of darting fish were on all sides of us. Giant underwater plants seemed to breathe in the ocean. And then before us stood the sunken pirate ship. It was embedded in the sand, and we could see a big hole in her side.
All kinds of fish were racing in and out of the rotted timbers, swirling in dizzy formations around the stumps of the masts, into open cabin doors and around the old rusty anchor.
Here, Ned, we can squeeze through this porthole.
There. We're inside.
We started walking down a passage, and as we touched some of the old wood from the ship, it would fall loose and start floating toward the surface. The ship had been here so long that the wood actually crumbled in our hands because of age. We could see the galley where the crew took their meals and the charting house with some of the old rusty instruments still there. From looking at the instruments, I guessed that the ship had probably been at the bottom of the ocean for 20 years or more. We came to a door which crumbled as we touched it. We went into the room. This was probably the captain's cabin.
Look, Ned! A treasure chest! I'll bet it's full of gold and diamonds. We'll be rich!
Conseil and I opened the chest and were amazed at what we saw. There before us were golden doubloons, pieces of eight, and a beautiful crown set with pearls. Just then I looked up. Stop! Conseil, stop!
What is it, Ned?
Over there, coming at us, a giant sea spider!
Conseil and I stood there frozen, not knowing what to do. I looked around, quickly trying to find something with which to protect us. But there was nothing that wouldn't just crumble in my hands. The underwater creature came closer and closer. And then, all of a sudden, something came from another direction.
A few moments later, Flipper swims as close to shore as possible near the rock where Penny and her mother still are trying to decide what to do with raw fish.
Mummy, Gwen, look. This little package lying here.
I don't remember seeing that earlier. What's inside?
Matches! Dry matches!
Matches? But they weren't there before.
I guess they were washed up from some boat. Unless they're flying matches.
Oh, Penny.
Well, all I know is that every time we need something, somehow we get it.
For 3 days, Sandy provides almost everything the castaways need. He leaves fruit for their breakfasts and split coconuts brimming with milk for thirst quenchers. Now, following a hidden path through the forest, he is carrying a large bunch of bananas, which he'll leave when the girls and their mother are not looking in his direction. But at this moment, Penny is coming along the same path from the other way. Neither one sees the other until they collide.
Oh!
Oh, who are you?
Please, forget I'm here. I'm hiding out.
Hiding out?
I'm a fugitive.
You're part of that gang that took Daddy away.
No, wait. Come back.
Give me the 4-1, George.
Oh, and a bottle of rum.
Change the quarters, heavy George.
I took the ship for you, didn't I?
I can't remember asking.
You said when the time was right.
Clap him in irons. Clap him in irons.
I'll carry out your orders, John, but I'm speaking in open council for you to give George Merry another chance. George here ain't the one to lay plans, but if you aims to take this stockade... Well, George is a good man in a fight. Too good to be rotting down below.
That's right. Yes,
that's
right.
That's very civil spoke, Israel Hands. And now we'll put him to Mr. Merry... if I'm to take any more of his source.
I'm with you, Captain.
All right, then. If I'm Captain, then this is orders. All hands ashore, except Israel and Agadir. The two of you remain on board and guard the ship.
Aye, sir.
If you're in trouble, you can signal me by firing the cannon.
Aye, sir.
And when you're doing sentry go... just ease off a point on the rum. Hear that, Agate?
The men in the stockade prepared to protect themselves from the pirates. It would be Jim's job to load the guns during the fight. Then they heard Long John Silver calling.
Agate, through!
Hold your positions. I've got to have a look.
Take a truce!
What do you want with your flag of truce?
Captain Silver to come aboard and make terms.
Captain Silver? Who's he?
Me, sir. These poor lads here have chosen me captain after your desertion, sir.
My man, I've got no desire to talk to you. But if you want to talk to me, you can come aboard. There'll be no treachery unless it's on your side.
The word of a gentleman be good enough for Long John.
It may be a trick. Gray, Joyce, Hunter, keep stations. That's far enough. Sit down.
Very well, sir. But one of you'll have to give me a leg up again. A sweet, pretty place you have here, to be sure. And there's Jim. I'll be my little matey. And squire and doctor. My service to we gentlemen.
If you've anything to say, you better say it.
You're right, Captain. Well, the long and the short of it be this. I want Flint's map, and I can risk half my crew to get him. But that ain't Captain Silver's way. Try reasoning first, says I. I never was one to see poor seamen shot down needless-like.
You're not in Parliament yet, John Silver. Come to the point.
You're a good man, Doctor. I never seen a better. And I'd hate to see the likes of you skewered on the end of a pike.
This story is not intended to be merely an autobiographical sketch, but rather a witness and a testimony of what God can do with the human heart and life and soul through the miracle of the new birth. Many there are who deny the inspiration of the Scriptures and doubt the supernatural power of Jesus Christ. Therefore, I hope and pray that this account of my own redemption will be a challenge to those who would scoff and ridicule the reality of a vital Christian experience. The world cannot, it dare not, deny the visible, audible, tangible evidence of a changed and a transformed life. How glad I am that I heard and heeded the still small voice of the Spirit of God as He spoke to my soul at the sound of eight bells in the morning watch of a wintry day in 1934.
A tropical island. And Nemo's men are rowing ashore.
What island is that?
From the trees and the vegetation, it would seem to be one of the islands near New Guinea.
I thought the captain never went ashore, Uncle.
Never ashore to civilization, Conseil. But this island is wild, and if there are people on it, they are probably cannibals.
Well, cannibals or not, I wish I were ashore.
The men are ashore now, and seem to be gathering things along the beach. Sacre bleu!
What is it, Uncle?
They are being chased by cannibals!
Captain Nemo and his men swiftly headed back to the ship with the cannibals in fast pursuit. As soon as they arrived on board, we could hear them securing all the top hatches. Soon, the cannibals were climbing on the top of the ship and trying to figure a way to get in.
Do you think Captain Nemo will take the ship under now, Uncle?
I do not know, Conseil. What is that strange noise?
Look at the cannibals! They're all jumping up and down on top of the ship, as if the metal was too hot to stand on. It looks like they're doing some kind of a crazy dance. Now they're all jumping in the water and swimming away as fast as they can. And they're getting in their boats. Boy, are they ever heading back to their island in a hurry. I wonder what could have caused all that.
Late that same afternoon, Penny, keeping watch beside the dried palm fronds, sees a tiny dot in the sky.
A plane. Oh, dear, where are those matches? Oh, here. My hands are shaking so much, I've got to light it. There.
Mummy! When?
Oh, where did they go?
It's a search plane. I hope they see us. Help! Help!
Help! Sandy, who notices the first puff of smoke, calls to Flipper.
Flipper, put it out. Put it out, hurry.
Dolphin, I'll never forgive you for this, never. And that goes for Sandy, too.
Long John Silver immediately set his men to attack. The action became fast and furious as they completely surrounded the stockade. Inside, the room was soon filled with smoke from the discharging guns. But the pirates could not gain entrance to the fort. They began backing away only to face the wrath of their leader. So once more, they went forward. Jim worked fast and hard and kept the rifles well loaded. Soon, the men were fighting outside. One of the pirates managed to get into the stockade building. Jim froze in terror. There was no one to protect him. When all of a sudden, Dr. Livesey entered, just in time to save his life. The fighting lasted a little longer, but finally, the pirates had to retreat.
Think they'll attack again?
I don't know, Jim. It's hard to foresee the end of this. Jim, take this map. I want you to have it, and just a precaution. It's yours by right, you know. And if the worst comes to the worst, don't hesitate to buy your life with it.
Now, the real danger was that the pirates would bring the ship within cannon range of the stockade. If it were only possible to cut the mooring line so she would go aground. But none of the men could be spared. Jim listened carefully to this and remembered that Ben Gunn had a homemade rowboat hidden in the mooring. When no one was looking, he slipped out of the stockade, rowed out to the ship under cover of darkness, and successfully cut the mooring lines. But his small rowboat floated away.
I was beginning to accustom myself to the sight of this interesting fishing when suddenly, as the Indian was on the ground, I saw him make a gesture of terror, rise, and make a spring to return to the surface of the sea. I understood his dread. A gigantic shadow appeared just above the unfortunate diver. It was a shark of enormous size advancing diagonally, his eyes on fire and his jaws open. I was mute with horror and unable to move. The voracious creature shot toward the Indian, who threw himself on one side in order to avoid the shark's fins, but not his tail, for it struck his chest and stretched him on the ground. This scene lasted but a few seconds. The shark returned and, turning on his back, prepared himself for cutting the Indian in two when I saw Captain Nemo rise suddenly, and then, dagger in hand, walk straight to the monster, ready to fight face to face with him. The very moment the shark was going to snap the unhappy fisherman in two, he perceived his new adversary, and, turning over, made straight toward him. I could still see Captain Nemo's position. Holding himself well together, he waited for the shark with admirable coolness, and, when it rushed at him, threw himself on one side with wonderful quickness, avoiding the shark and burying his dagger deep into its side. But it was not all over. A terrible combat ensued. The shark had seemed to roar, if I might say so. The blood rushed in torrents from its wound. The sea was dyed red, and through the opaque liquid I could distinguish nothing more. Nothing more until the moment when, like lightning, I saw the undaunted captain hanging on to one of the creature's fins, struggling, as it were, hand to hand with the monster, and dealing successive blows at his enemy, yet still unable to give a decisive one. The shark's struggles agitated the water with such fury that the rocking threatened to upset me. I wanted to go to the captain's assistant, but nailed to the spot with horror, I could not stir. I saw the haggard eye, I saw the different phases of the fight. The captain fell to the earth, upset by the enormous mass which leant upon him. The shark's jaws opened wide like a pair of factory shears, and it would have been all over with the captain, but quick as a thought, harpoon in hand, Ned Land rushed towards the shark and struck it with its sharp point. The waves were impregnated with a mass of blood. They rocked under the shark's movements, which beat them with indescribable fury. Ned Land had not missed his aim. It was the monster's death rattle. Struck to the heart, it struggled with dreadful convulsions, the shock of which overthrew Conseil. But Ned Land had disentangled the captain, who, getting up without any wound, went straight to the Indian, quickly cut the cord which held him to his stone, took him in his arms, and, with a sharp blow of his heel, mounted to the surface. We all three followed in a few seconds, saved by a miracle, and reached the fisherman's boat. Captain Nemo's first care was to recall the unfortunate man to life again. I did not think he could succeed. I hoped so, for the poor creature's immersion was not long, but the blow from the shark's tail might have been his death blow. Happily, with the captain's and Conseil's sharp friction, I saw consciousness return by degrees. He opened his eyes. What was his surprise, his terror, even, at seeing four great copper heads leaning over him? And above all, what must he have thought when Captain Nemo, drawing from the pocket of his suit a bag of pearls, placed them in his hand? This munificent charity from the man of the waters to the poor Cingalese was accepted with a trembling hand. His wondering eyes showed that he knew not to what superhuman beings he owed both fortune and life. At a sign from the captain, we regained the bank, and, following the road already traversed, came in about half an hour to the anchor which held the canoe of the Nautilus to the earth. Once on board, we each, with the help of the sailors, got rid of the heavy copper helmet. Captain Nemo's first word was to the Canadian. "Thank you, Master Land," said he. "It was in repayment, Captain," replied Ned Land. "I owed you that." A ghastly smile passed across the captain's lips, and that was all.
Gil Bateson sends his two confederates to shore, and soon they're back on board the yacht with Lady Julia, Gwen, and Penny. Then Gil hands Sir Halsey a sheet of paper on which the convict has scribbled a message to be sent over ship's radio.
All right, here's what you're to say and nothing else. Now go ahead and send it.
Yes, I guess I have no choice.
None at all.
Very well. Mayday, mayday, mayday. This is Sir Halsey Phillips. I can send this message only once. Please tape record if you can. My wife, my two daughters, and I are being held as hostages by Gil Bateson. He and his associates want a guarantee of immunity and safe conduct to wherever they wish to go. If they do not receive it within 24 hours, they'll kill me and my family.
Oh, Daddy.
Do not, I repeat, do not attempt to conduct any search activities. Stay away, I repeat, stay away, or they will kill us at once.
And I mean it.
Penny realizes that their only hope of escaping from the convicts might rest with Sandy. Desperately, she turns toward the island and gives the signal. She searches the shore, but sees no sign of the boy.
Hey, what are you doing, sister?
Oh, nothing. Just practicing my bird whistles. I always do that when I'm nervous.
Yeah, well, cut it out. It makes me nervous.
You want to see that doctor, don't he, Jim? If I take you as far as the stockade, will you give me your affidavit not to slip your cable? Word of honor.
Word of honor.
Right, men. Stand by here while I parleys with him. And keep a sharp lookout on all sides. I'll keep a weather eye out for a man what's trying to get a foot in each camp, and him with only one leg. You'd better come back with that map and the hostage, Captain Silver.
Doctor!
Steady, lad, steady, Jim.
He's had a rum go of it, sir.
Taken to knifing boys, eh, Silver?
Not me, sir. You could cut my... my good leg off afore I'd raise a finger against that there lad. Why, when he comes crawling into the fort half dead, I says to myself, you gotta save that dear boy, John. Captain would wish it, Squire would wish it, and you'd wish it.
So Captain Silver is minded to join us again, eh?
I'll be honest and open with you, as I always am. When I climbed the fort and seen the Hispaniola flying that Union Jack, I knew I'd been taught a lesson by my betters. I thinks gold dust of this dear boy. I've took to him like pitch.
You'd have killed me yourself if you'd have had that map. But you'll not get it. I'd die first.
You're a mite late to talk of dying. No, old Johnny ain't human, he ain't. He didn't care about saving his little mate his life, not him. All he wanted was this here map.
Very well, you have the map. But what good is a treasure without a ship to haul it?
And what could be a ship if 'tis only to haul me to execution, Doc? I bain't no coward, Doctor, but the thought of them there gallows gives me the shakes. Now, if I was to save young Arkins' life, do we think you could save mine into the bargain?
You save him.
I could guard the boy while I plays a treasure hunting with them scum. But they'll not give him up till they seize the treasure dug. Now, wouldn't that warrant a good word to the captain?
I want to speak with the boy alone.
Speak and welcome, and make a note of that, too. But go on with your doctoring while you talks. One false move and they'll fire.
Jim, I don't know how you managed to save us that ship.
But I lost the map.
And the map's not important to us now, but your safety is. So you're not going back to those fellows. Now listen carefully. I'll make a quick break to draw their fire. The moment I do, you fall flat. Then before they've time to reload, you're up and running and we both head for the woods, right?
I can't.
Why not?
I gave Long John my word.
Just as soon as I got back to my cabin, I made a lot of messages, put them in bottles, went topside, and threw them into the sea when no one was looking. It seemed like a pretty hopeless attempt, but at this point we were desperate. The next week passed by calmly. The professor spent a great deal of time with Captain Nemo discussing science and the sea. The professor was very pleased by all that he was learning. Captain Nemo even showed him more of the ship. The two scientists had a great deal of respect for each other. Conseil spent a lot of time teaching Snoopy new tricks, and at the end of the week, called me in for a grand performance. I still hoped that maybe just by chance, some ship may discover one of the bottles. Suddenly, one day, we encountered a tropical hurricane as forceful as the one which sunk the Abraham Lincoln. Immediately, the Nautilus dove deep into the ocean. The hurricane didn't seem to bother her at all below the sea. It was amazing to think that above us was a terrible storm. But here, we were below the surface in the quiet and peace of life under the sea. And all of a sudden, there was this terrible crash. Apparently, the steering rudder had been slightly damaged by the force of the hurricane, and we were unable to clear a large cluster of rocks. One of the seams of the ship was slightly ripped, and water began pouring in.
Set the emergency pumps.
Captain, is there anything I can do to help?
Yes. Help those men secure that watertight door so that the water won't escape into the rest of the ship.
All right, men. We were finally able to secure the door when suddenly there was another crash and the lights and power went off. Immediately, the emergency reserve supply furnished some light, but the new damage had to be taken care of right away or we would all perish under the sea.
How much water in the power compartment?
5 feet and rising, sir.
We can't breathe these fumes. I must have power.
The shaft jammed solid, sir.
Clear it, then. I can't work a dead ship. Get the spare shaft. Unlimber the hoist. Take up the slack.
Aye, aye, sir.
Soon, the new shaft was in place.
Wherever you're listening to this broadcast, I invite you to join with the crew and me in prayer. Our Father and our God, in Jesus' name, we touch the throne of grace today. I thank you for this opportunity of sharing with my friends what you did for me that wintry day in San Diego. How glad I am that you sought till you found me, answering the prayers of my godly mother, wife, children, family, and friends. Use this story to touch hearts, I pray. Bring the unsaved to yourself. restore the backslidden to fellowship with you. Bring glory to your name through these words. This is my humble prayer. In the lovely name of Jesus, our Redeemer and our Savior. Amen.
Flipper hovers in the water just below the surface, watching the cans drift close to the yacht.
Hey, Barney, those cans floating by look like they still got food in them. Must be from a wreck. With all these extra passengers, we'll need some more extra supplies. Go on and fetch them.
This is the opportunity Flipper has been waiting for. Barney reaches over the side of the yacht and just manages to grab a can when Flipper dives out of the water and slams into him. At the same time, Sandy swims underwater from the nearby rocks and grabs Barney. He pulls the convict toward the entrance to the underwater cave. While on board the yacht...
Hey, what happened to Barney? What was that?
A shark! It got him! I saw it! It was this long!
Well, what do you know? Gone, just like that.
When Barney is safely a prisoner in the underwater cave, Sandy rejoins Flipper near the yacht. Then, while Sandy starts to climb aboard on one side, Flipper puts on a performance on the other to distract the convicts.
Hey, look at that crazy dolphin, will you? You keep an eye on it, Ish. I gotta stick by the radio.
As Sandy sneaks closer to the fascinated convict, Sir Halsey is gradually working himself into a position to jump Gil Bateson. Suddenly, Sandy and Sir Halsey each leap upon the killers.
Don't worry, Penny.
What's going on?
I'll help him.
Sandy finds himself no match for the burly Ish and retreats toward the bow. But Ish is almost upon him when Sandy realizes that his only chance lies in some kind of a trick. He dives overboard.
It was horrible. For one instant, I thought the unhappy man entangled with the pulp would be torn from its powerful suction. 7 of the 8 arms had been cut off. Only one wriggled in the air, brandishing the victim like a feather. But just as Captain Nemo and his lieutenant threw themselves on it, the animal ejected a stream of black liquid. We were blinded with it. When the cloud dispersed, the cuttlefish had disappeared, and my unfortunate countryman with it. 10 or 12 pulps now invaded the platform and sides of the Nautilus. We rolled pell-mell into the midst of this mass of serpents that wriggled on the platform in the waves of blood and ink. It seemed as though these slimy tentacles sprang up like the Hydra's heads. Ned Land's harpoon at each stroke was plunged into the staring eyes of the cuttlefish. But my bold companion was suddenly overturned by the tentacles of a monster he had not been able to avoid. Ah! How my heart beat with emotion and horror. The formidable beak of a cuttlefish was open over Ned Land. The unhappy man would be cut in two. I rushed to his succor, but Captain Nemo was before me. His axe disappeared between the two enormous jaws and miraculously saved. The Canadian, rising, plunged his harpoon deep into the triple heart of the pulp.
Well, I'm not the best harpoonist on the high seas for nothing, you know.
Well, gentlemen, I'm happy to report that all the members of the crew have been saved. And, Ned, I want to especially thank you for saving my life. The least I can do is let you all return to your homes. Take one of my small boats. I'll give you plenty of supplies, plus a compass, and soon you'll be back in civilization.
Capitaine, come with us. Share your secret with the world.
This is my home, Professor. The sea and the world beneath it.
And does that clear you of the crime of mutiny?
Please, sir. He did save my life.
Jim's right. Silver kept his side of the bargain.
Then you're both free to testify on his behalf. He'll have a fair trial in England. Squire Trelawney, while the doctor's helping me down to the beach, I suggest you get a load aboard the ship. Take John Silver along and put him in irons.
Aye, aye, sir.
With Jim at the till and accompanied by Squire Trelawney, Long John Silver was transported back to the ship. But just before arriving, Long John pulled out a hidden pistol. He commanded the squire to jump overboard and swim for shore. He then told Jim to set a true course through the channel, and there he would release him. But Jim ran the boat aground and jumped out. He stood in defiance to Long John Silver and the direct beam of his pistol.
Here! Avast!
shove me off.
I'll take no orders from you.
You put me on air, now you'll shove me off. Or by the powers, you'll get what I gave George Mary.
Long John Silver could not bring himself to shoot the boy. Jim knew this, and although they were on opposite sides, he could not let John be captured. He rushed to the boat and pushed it free of the rocks.
I might have known you'd never let him hang your old shipmate. Goodbye, matey. Good luck to ye.
Lost him. I could almost find it in my heart to hope he makes it.
And so, Jim and the doctor stood quietly looking toward the channel opening and watched Long John Silver row his boat into the open sea toward the sunset. Both of them silently hoping he would find his freedom.
Yeah, the propeller must be snagged. I'll have to go over the side and clear it. But first, all of you, get inside that cabin.
As soon as he has the Hopewell family locked up, Bateson goes over the side of the yacht, and underwater he uses a knife to cut the rope from around the fouled propeller. He is just about to return to the surface when Flipper gives him a powerful blow with his tail. Immediately, Bateson has his knife ready. Again and again, Bateson lunges desperately at Flipper, who tries to keep clear of the flashing knife blade, and at the same time hit Bateson again. At last, Flipper has a chance. He strikes Bateson full force. As he swerves to get away, Bateson, just before he passes out, manages to plunge the knife into Flipper.
And now our songs are ended, but may their melody linger on, for the story they're told is ageless. And though these singers be gone, as we set sail and stand out to sea, may they speak to your heart while we're apart of the stranger of Galilee.
Later, when Porter Rick, Sandy's father, brings the boy the news.
He'll be all right, son. Flipper's going to be all right.
I'm glad he'll get better. But he won't be all right, Pop. Not as long as they keep him here.
Don't worry about that, son. Nobody's going to part you and Flipper. My ranger appointment came through, and from now on, we'll all be living at the Coral Key Marine Preserve. Me, you, and Flipper.
Oh, Pop. That's great. That's just great.
And in a few days, Flipper is well enough to swim around the Seaquarium tank and even to ask Sandy for a game of water basketball.
Not yet, Flipper. Not until we go home, okay?
No.